Welcome to Ask the Experts, a monthly podcast taking on the latest questions around healthcare legislation and compliance.
Welcome to another edition of Ask the Experts. Today's expert is Crystal Burtner, Senior Compliance Specialist. Welcome to the podcast, Crystal.
Thanks, Shelley. Great to be here.
So let's get started with our first question. We are offering an HSA qualified high deductible health plan to employees, and it renews on December 1st of 2024. I read somewhere about telehealth relief expiring for HSA qualified plans. What action is required to make sure our plan is compliant?
So during COVID, temporary relief was offered for HSA qualified plans to offer telehealth services prior to satisfying the deductible. For plan years that are renewing on or after January 1st of 2025, this will need to be discontinued to preserve the HSA eligibility of the plan. With this particular plan renewing on December 1st of 2024, action would not be required until the plan renews on December 1st of 2025. Now, when the plan does renew at that time, you'll want to make sure that the telehealth services are not being offered prior to meeting the deductible.
Are employees capped at how much they can contribute to a health savings account if they aren't enrolled in an HSA qualified high deductible health plan for the full year?
Generally, yes. The annual HSA contribution limit is based on the number of months during the year that you're eligible for the HSA. There is, however, one exception to this, which is known as the last month rule. Now, under the last month rule, if an individual is eligible to contribute to the HSA on December 1st, then they are considered an eligible individual for that entire year and would be able to contribute the full annual IRS maximum if they choose to.
What if an employee makes a mistake and over-contributes to their HSA?
There is an excise tax of 6% that would apply for any excess contributions if that is not corrected prior to the April 15th tax filing deadline. This can be corrected by the funds being distributed back to the individual and then appropriately taxed. As long as the correction is done before the April 15th tax deadline, the 6% excise tax will not apply. The individual would just need to work with the bank that they have their HSA with to request the correction.
And the last one on this, we have an employee who wants to stop their HSA contributions just for the month of December. Are they allowed to do this?
Yes, so employers must allow employees to change their HSA contribution at least one time a month.
Regarding the gag clause attestation, does the responsibility for completing this fall on the carrier or on the employer?
That depends. If the plan is fully insured, the carriers are the responsible party, but employers still want to make sure that they're getting confirmation of this in writing from the carrier. Now, if the plan is self-funded, which includes level-funded plans, the employer is the responsible party. With those level-funded plans, there may be some carriers who will handle this on behalf of employers, but they'll want to confirm that in writing.
And when is the attestation due?
The deadline to submit this to CMS is December 31st, but in cases where the carriers or a third-party administrator are doing the reporting, they may have earlier deadlines than this if they have requested information back from the employer to complete the attestation submission.
We have an employee who has a domestic partner on their benefits, and the premium for the domestic partner is being taken out of the employee's paycheck post-tax. Why is it done this way?
Yeah, so this is a stipulation that's under federal law, and federal law permits only certain individuals, which would be employees, spouses, and tax dependents, to receive tax-favored treatment of the benefits that are provided under a group health plan. In most cases, the domestic partner portion of the premium would need to be treated as imputed income to the employee for federal tax purposes, unless the domestic partner is the employee's tax dependent. I do want to point out that this is regarding the federal tax specifically. For state tax purposes, it may be different. In California, for example, if the employee resides in California, the value of the registered domestic partner's coverage under that plan does not result in imputed income to the employee.
I had an employee come to me and ask about a line item on their paycheck that showed group life insurance imputed income. What is that for?
Section 79 of the Internal Revenue Code addresses imputed income on group term life insurance. And Section 79 states that coverage in excess of $50,000 must be taxed as income using the IRS premium table. That excess is also subject to Social Security and Medicare taxes.
So how much tax must be taken out?
This is based on the IRS premium table, and this rate table can be found in IRS Publication 15B, which is known as the Employer's Tax Guide to Fringe Benefits.
Why is non-discrimination testing typically performed at the end of the year instead of when the plan renews?
Sometimes initial testing is necessary at the beginning of the plan year, but the testing must be performed before the last day of the plan year. This also allows any necessary changes to be made before individuals are filing their individual tax returns.
How does that testing get completed?
Employers want to make sure that they're working with either their payroll provider or an outside vendor or a third-party administrator to conduct the annual non-discrimination testing.
We have an employee that has been out on workers' comp since April. The employee has not been paying their portion of the premium and has requested that we go ahead and cancel their benefits. Is it okay for us to go ahead and cancel them?
Once any FMLA eligibility runs out, if that applies, employers are not obligated to continue the benefits, as the employee likely no longer meets that eligibility definition to continue benefits at that point. Now, it is a good idea to look at the SPD or the RAP document, as well as the employee handbook, to ensure that the situation is being handled according to anything that's in writing. Now, with that being said, generally, if an employee is on a leave of absence and not paying for the cost of insurance, employers are able to go ahead and cancel the health insurance. State continuation or COBRA would then be offered, depending on which one applies.
After we cancel the benefits, do we terminate the employee or keep them on as an employee?
That's something that employers must decide individually, but it is best for them to speak with their own attorney before taking any actions such as this.
Thank you, Crystal. We hope you found this podcast helpful and informative. Please join us next month for another edition of Ask the Experts. This podcast is designed to highlight various employee benefit matters of general interest to our listeners. It is not intended to interpret laws or regulations or to address specific client situations. You should not act or rely on any information contained herein without seeking the advice of an attorney or tax professional.